Hello, a very good evening to you. My name's David Jay, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the very last On the Front Foot cricket chat show of the 2018 season here at Suzy 103.4. Tim is the other side of the panel from me. Chris Jacobs is going to join us for 30 minutes or so for a bit of punditry. Tim, the long hot summer of 2018 seems to have evaporated.
Well, it does, but I have to say I didn't expect when we scheduled all these shows right at the start of the season that our October show would have temperatures 16 degrees.
It was 75 degrees yesterday in Old Money here outside the studio. Downright better weather for cricket than in Sri Lanka, but we'll come to that a little bit later on. Chris, have you recovered from your exertions?
Just about.
Well, it's very nice to have you back here. Don't want to spend a long time talking about it, but I hope you had a wonderful time in the US of A.
Yes, it was incredible again.
And did you manage to introduce our American cousins to a little bit more cricket? I ask that because the Caribbean 50-over tournament has suddenly popped up on ESPN BT Sport.
Yeah.
And the USA are taking part in that.
The USA is growing massively, especially around New York. There's a lot of... there's the Pakistani and Indian contingent out there that are absolutely loving it. But in terms of... one of the activities we did, one of the electives, it was arguably one of the most popular things that was around. They absolutely loved it.
And have they played it before?
Some of them had played it the year before with me and knew I would do it, but some of them were just new. But after a few weeks, we actually got them into getting rid of that disgusting baseball technique and actually getting them standing up and playing cricket properly, and then they realise, oh, I can hit the ball on the offside now. I can actually hit it further standing up like this and with a backlift. So to be able to actually teach them proper technique was quite fulfilling to actually bring across to them.
That's why I played Explode by Cover Drive just when you were taking over from me. The elegance of the blade as it's waved through the covers by D.I. Gower all those years ago. It was interesting, I can't recall his name, it's a subcontinental name, but one of the CPL teams had an opening bowler from the USA, so it's beginning to take root. And of course our friends in Jersey played an ICC Division 4 World Cricket League in Los Angeles last year.
It's amazing, isn't it, how it starts to touch all corners of the world now. I suppose with satellite TV and all the different coverage, I suppose it's inevitable that it will start to become more popular.
And equally, I know we're going to talk about broadcasting later, but with that Caribbean 50-over tournament popping up on BT Sport via ESPN, it's virtually every day of the year on cable, satellite,
Is that particular tournament with the likes of Barbados against the Leeward Islands, Guyana, all those sorts of teams, and the US are included within that?
Jamaica call themselves the Scorpions. I'm not sure what the rest do, but I'm struggling with Outward Outlaws at the moment.
I'm quite surprised that they've actually got a 50-over tournament. 2020, I can understand, but I'm glad because I like 50-over cricket, but I'm quite surprised that they've actually begun to actually have a proper Caribbean 50-over tournament. That's an interesting move for them, I think.
I think it's probably a good thing. I mean, at least it's 30 overs longer than what Owen Morgan is recommending be cut by 50%.
Well, yeah. I assume that they're doing that as part of a run-up to the World Cup, I guess.
I suppose. Yeah. We'll get onto that later on as well, no doubt. We've got about half an hour to chat now. And Tim, I suppose there's not really a great deal of point in banging on ad nauseam about the end of the local club season and who did what. We've got Outward coming in to receive their award after 7:30. I mean, in the Premiership, East Grinstead disappointed, Roffey ran away with it in Sussex, and without wishing to labour the point, Reigate Priory came second, having led the division all season in Surrey.
Yeah, there was a little bit of, well, do we want to call it choking? It was a bit of a, at the end of the season, they sort of threw it away a little bit, Reigate Priory. It was theirs to win, wasn't it? And they lost it quite badly.
Tim, I've always been very reluctant to label the South Africans as chokers, so perhaps we'll keep on one side. You may be interested to know, Chris, that while you've been away, there have been talks and negotiations about bringing back football
okay.
to Bletchingley Village, Grange Meadow, there in the middle of the village, traditionally hosted both a football club and a cricket club, and the facilities are still there. And somebody had the bright idea that if they were going to try and bring the football back, they'd have a shot at bringing the Bletchingley Cricket Club back to life, which is rather a reversal of so much, Tim, that we've seen happening locally.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly we're seeing clubs folding, aren't we? And it's nice to see a village that's trying to bring back the old cricket club. How long ago did it fold?
I would suspect in the 80s. It may be later than that. When you get to my age, all these decades run into one another. My skipper at the grammar school in 1979 was Phil Tidy, and he and his dad played principally for Bletchingley at Grange Meadow, although they were also involved at South Godston, which is another sports club which has lost its cricket club completely. I don't think you'd even find the square if you
But isn't it ironic that, like, Chris, you're over in America and and the sport's growing there.
It's massive.
And in this country, clubs are folding. All right, Bletchingley's the exception.
It's the struggle. It's the real struggle, because you've got to think that will people have time on their Saturdays and Sundays to turn out? Because people work so many jobs now, and obviously the times we are in, people need money to live with housing prices and everything skyrocketing. They don't have time to play cricket on the weekend and pay however £10-15 match fee. And it really takes out of people's pockets in particular. But it's nice to see some of these village clubs come back. I'd love to see, like, the likes of South Godston, as you mentioned. But there's one ground that sticks in my head. I think it used to be owned by the BBC. It was up in Motspur Park. And when I go to college every day, I go past it on the train. It's just a sorry sight.
Yeah,
it's a sorry sight of a cricket club and what it was, because it was an incredible pitch.
Yeah,
because my dad always mentions it to me. It was like, it was the best pitch around, best outfield, best pitch, best tees.
Yeah, well, that's important.
Which is why we.
But it's amazing how quickly when there is no activity on the ground, how quickly it just goes back to nature and it's not looked after. But it makes such a massive difference to villages when there's a cricket team that's active during the summer. It was the same at Charwood. I played for Charwood for 15 to 20 years. And in the early 2000s, the club folded because we just couldn't get teams out. We only had one team in the end on a Sunday, and we just couldn't get any players to play. Most of the players that were playing then were from outside of Charwood. I think Ifield used the ground now on occasion, but there's no Charwood Cricket Club, and
I think it's
terrible.
The youngsters as well. The youngsters coming through, they don't want to play cricket. They won't want to play Saturday and Sunday cricket. And they're at school and college 5 days a week. They want to be social. They want to do other things. They want to explore different avenues. But to play Saturday cricket, which is still declaration cricket midway through the season, which is 12 midday for the first and second team, is all the way up till 7 at night
sometimes.
It's
a long day.
And then you've got Sunday when you're playing like the likes of 40 over games. Yeah. So there goes your Sunday and there goes your weekend.
Leatherhead Cricket
away.
Club's third 11, who I used to play for, folded about 2 years ago. This season, they've just, in the last couple of weeks, they've applied to have a third 11 playing next year in the Surrey Downs League.
Because
originally
they were in the
Surrey Championship.
Yeah.
And ironically, it was discussed 2 or 3 years ago as a way of trying to stem the fact that the thirds were likely to fold. Unfortunately, the club didn't take up the idea.
Is there a second ground for that third 11 to play on?
Well, that's the problem at Leatherhead, is that back in 2006 they merged with Cobham, and we were able to use Cobham's cricket ground, but that only lasted a few years. And I think there's plans to try and use another ground. They have been using Headley, they've used Freeman's cricket ground.
Headley's a very good shout, but Headley have brought their club back. I've seen games down at Headley.
I think there's plans for Leatherhead to try and use another ground, but that's part of the problem, is trying to have a proper ground that they can use regularly.
Headley's never gone away. Headley has been
I think it's one of my favourite cricket grounds.
They're in the Surrey Downs League, and they've amalgamated with Old Freeman's, and they've got a flourishing Sunday setup. Let's move on, if we may, because Time's Winged Chariot is already breathing down our neck, to mix a couple of metaphors. And there are two gentlemen I want to mention. We've touched on this as the season's gone by, never really had the chance to delve into any detail. John Turner at Merstham, who at the age of 76 earlier in the season made his maiden 100 in the whole of his life.
Wow.
Playing for Surrey over 70s seconds against Kent over 70s seconds. He carried his bat in a total getting on for 300 for 129 not out. And Kent gave up. They blocked, apparently, from ball one. But congratulations to John Turner.
That must have been a nice celebration.
That is a living legend right there.
Oh, yes.
I'm beginning to regret hanging my boots up. It's as we've said before, it's running about in the field that's the problem, unless you're playing over 70s. And when I was a boy in Caterham, the Horrocks dynasty were just about the most renowned local cricketers. And Sid Horrocks, 60 years ago, would already have been just approaching 30. And this marvellous game, just outside our area, that Wallingham Cricket Club threw, in which Sid played as he approached the age of 90 in a scratch side called 90 Not Out against Wallingham, and his two sons, his nephew, two grandsons and family friends all played in the game. Now, as I say, the Horrockses were 60 years ago. When I was a little boy, they were as close to cricketing royalty at Caterham as it got. I know they played at Netherne for many years as well. And so that was Sid Horrocks.
Do we know how Sid got on during that game?
I don't think it's been reported or recorded, but what a marvellous
occasion.
Amazing,
yeah, that's amazing. Yeah,
so,
90.
So Sid never retired. Gentlemen, let me throw the ball to you that we have very recently bid farewell not just to Alistair Cook, but also to Paul Collingwood.
Yeah, we lost Paul Collingwood. He's been, I mean, it feels like Paul Collingwood has been around the cricket scene for decades.
I didn't think he was ever going to retire.
No.
I thought he was going to play till he was like 75.
Yeah.
But he's one of those players that established himself. I think it was the back end of that 2005 Ashes series. What was the fourth test he came in?
Well, that's right, because it was always Shane Warne that took the mickey out of him, didn't he? Because
yeah.
I think he played one test and he got an MBE, and I think in subsequent series Shane Warne always sledged him whenever he came in, because
yeah.
he didn't play a huge part in that, although he was in that series.
I think still that one innings that sticks in my head, although I think it was in a losing cause, it was a draw, that 200 he got.
Yeah.
In, I think it was it the fourth test when we lost 4-5-0?
Yeah.
In that Flintoff series, that infamous Flintoff series,
yeah,
where he was
right.
the captain.
But it was 5-0, wasn't it?
It was 5-0.
We got whitewashed.
We got whitewashed, but he still managed to stick in there and put a good account of himself with a double 100 under that kind of circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't just his batting prowess, he'd been able to bowl like quite cheeky medium pace, use the variations like his off cutters and leg cutters, and that's without even talking about his fielding.
Ian Botham, this is what Ian Botham said. Now bear in mind Ian Botham's biased because he's the Durham chairman, okay, but Ian Botham said Paul is one of the greatest all-rounders to ever grace the game of cricket, and to have him playing at Durham, his home county, for all these years has been an absolute privilege.
I'd probably say he's up there. I'd say he's up there. I'd say there's probably two tiers of it. You've got the likes of Beefy, Imran Khan, Kapil Dev, and then I'd probably say there's like a group below, and I'd say he's in there because he's not on that level.
Well, let's not forget he's the first England skipper to win a global tournament, wasn't he?
Probably, true.
If you don't include the Adam Holyoake tournament back in Sharjah way back when, he won the ICC World T20 in 2010. So
that was the KP tournament.
Yeah.
That was the KP show, that whole tournament.
Oh, it was.
But fair play for
it. But Collingwood was the captain.
He captained it. But I think it's just the setting and the tone he put in the field, in terms of he would stand up and he produced. I still remember that catch he took off Matthew Hayden, a backward point, that literally came to him in like milliseconds, and he's flown like 10 feet in the air, one-handed, weak hand, and
he made his
it.
First class debut back in 1996.
That was when I was born.
It's extraordinary, really, isn't it? I mentioned this, alluded to this on the last show, always just marred for me ever so slightly by that thing with Grant Elliott in the one day at the Oval.
That's
which
right.
I'm sure even a hard case like Paul Collingwood must regret. I would guess that he has now got an eye on high level coaching. He's already done a number of jobs with the England setup and with others.
Yeah.
And I would guess that you know, that is his
aim. Think you're right, though. That incident was a real shame, because he had the opportunity to reverse that decision. The umpires gave him the opportunity, and the umpires took a lot of stick for that. They had no choice but to give that decision once Paul Collingwood had appealed. They had to give the guy out. The fact that he wouldn't reverse the decision was a real shame. And like you, when you watch it back now, it's very uncomfortable to watch. And you wonder what's going... I mean, I know these guys are professional sportsmen and they want to win, that for me personally, you want to win fairly. You don't want to win.
It's like that guy, the Sri Lankan guy, the last time we were over there when they mancadded Jos Buttler.
Yeah,
that is so uncomfortable to watch.
Exactly.
Just the shock and the reaction that the bowler's actually done that.
Mm.
Was there not a West Indian under 19 mancad possibly in the final?
Yeah. That's right. Yes, there was. I think that was against. I'm sure that was against Zimbabwe, and they had. I think it was. It was either in the semis or the final, and it's the same thing. It's just terrible to watch.
Chris, presumably with the internet and that mobile device that you clutch all the time and all the rest of it, being in the USA no longer means being divorced from international cricket.
Absolutely not.
And you were able to follow what was going on in the India series?
Yeah? I was watching highlights constantly, and I was lucky enough. I came back on, I think I flew back on the day two of the final test at the Oval, and I managed to go day four to see Cook's 100, and I managed to go see day five and see Jimmy Anderson break Glenn McGrath's record.
That's a very good reason for flying all the way back from the States. Did it cost you anything to get in on the last day?
Last day, £25.
Well, that's a lot less than it cost me to sit in a seat in the stand at Lord's. From a distance, Chris, what about your summing up of Alistair Cook? Because we've had our go last time.
I feel, obviously, Cookie has been an incredible servant to English cricket, and I don't think we'll ever see anybody like him again. Unfortunately, he's that type of opener. It's not, he's not the most talented player, but I'd say he's up there, probably the most mentally strong player I've ever seen play the game. And that is high credit, considering some of the players that we've seen over the years. But he plays to his strengths. He didn't do something that he couldn't do. He wouldn't play reverse sweeps. He wouldn't play ramp shots. He could play the cut shot. He could play off his hip. And occasionally he'd play a drive, pull shot in particular as well, but he would stick to his strengths, which was key for him and why it made him so successful. Although he did have periods where he did struggle and then he'd get a big score, I don't think, although there were rumours of him getting dropped, he was never going to get dropped, just because of his leadership in the team, and he's going to leave a big hole. But I feel like him now retiring, that takes the pressures off the other openers. I think a brand new pair at the top of the order, although it'll be risky with him not there anymore, I think all the openers that have been alongside, I think it's, 15 openers by now? I think not having him there kind of takes the weight off their shoulders, because they're going in to arguably bat with England's greatest batsman.
You're quite right what you said. The mental strength that he has is so obvious when he goes out to bat, and you can just see in his eyes that he can just stay there. And it's so lacking in the rest of the England setup now that whether it's because he's of the last generation perhaps, which was able to build innings and view it as a time, just to bat time, whereas now you watch the players come in and they just can't help themselves. It's so drilled into them to play limited overs cricket, whether it's T20 or 50 over, whatever it is, that they just don't seem capable of staying there for that length of time. And
no,
it's so rare.
Isn't.
And this is why we have test matches rarely going to 5 days.
No, which is painful to see, because it's killing off test cricket. But I think the only player I've seen come in and produce an innings of a Cook-like nature, he's a young lad, he's struggling at the moment, but Haseeb Hamid in India last time round was the only kind of guy that I saw and think convinced he would stick around for a long time and grind something out. All the guys we're bringing in now is coming through white ball cricket, and it seems like we're going to play 3-day test matches soon.
Well, now you're quite right. We have more and more players that are signing white ball contracts. There was another one I read today, Max Waller, he's signed a white ball contract.
Has he?
Yeah. And that doesn't help test cricket. You mentioned Hamid. The problem I think with Hamid was that he sort of came onto the scene very quickly, dazzled, and then he's got injured and then never seemed to recover his form.
No, he hasn't, no.
And he's never, since I think he broke a finger or something to do with his hand. Ever since that injury he's struggled, and until he can start producing the runs at county level, which he just hasn't done, he's never gonna get back in that
but
side.
But there's some lads that should be given a go though, because they're giving youngsters a go all the time, which is fair enough. Put a new injection of youth into the side, but sometimes it's better to go back for that experience. You see some of these players, some of the players that haven't played for England, James Hildreth at Somerset. Multiple seasons where he scored over 1,000 runs. His problem was it was that side where you couldn't replace them. You could literally name them Trott, Peterson,
James Hildreth scored 833 county championship runs this year, an average of 49.
And that number five I just said, Ian Bell.
Yeah.
That guy right there, he has had an incredible season for Warwickshire.
871 runs.
Exactly, 871
average
runs.
Average 62.21.
He's
that's a
36. But what is the problem with bringing him back in for the experience? He's played at that level. He's played international level. And then you see these players, the likes of Adam Voges and Chris Rogers, who flourished at the later ages and scored runs at test level. So why not, if he's scoring runs, you're supposed to pick people on merit. Not
David, you know, we've been banging the drum for Rory Burns all
season,
haven't
we? Well, at least Rory Burns has been picked.
Thank goodness he's in there,
Can we just look ahead a little bit, because as ever time flies, Sri Lanka at the moment, albeit the monsoon season, which seems to me a bizarre piece of scheduling, then West Indies and then the World Cup. Do you think that the World Cup, 50-over cricket, is becoming a means to an end, and that we're entering a dangerously short-term period with England in the future, where Trevor Bayliss's time is nearly up and poor Andrew Strauss has been forced to quit his post, in which at all accounts he was being hugely successful because of his wife's serious illness? How do you see England going forward up to the World Cup and the Ashes?
I think with the World Cup, the whole strategy that Andrew Strauss has been based on the World Cup. Trevor Bayliss was brought in really to try and shake up the one-day side, which he's done massively successfully. Unfortunately, it's probably been to the detriment of the Test side. I think it will be interesting to see, once the World Cup's over, whether the New England coach is going to be split, whether it's going to be the same coach that's going to coach the Test team as the one day side, whether they're going to keep it together. It will depend, I guess, on who takes Andrew Strauss's job. I think Andy Flower is doing it in the short term, but I don't know who's going to take that particular role. I'm a massive fan of the World Cup. I've always loved the Cricket World Cup. I enjoy 50-over cricket. I'm not a huge fan of international T20. I know we've got Matt Camp coming on later, and I think T20 for local cricket is brilliant, and I think it will probably save cricket in many places because it's a short form of the game.
Yeah.
For international cricket, I'm not a fan of it. But I think the World Cup is so important. We've still not won it. We've never won the World Cup. We got close several times. I think the last time we were in the final was 92.
Yeah, when we lost Pakistan.
We lost to Pakistan in the final, who we'd already beaten. So it's very important. But I think it will really depend on how they go forward with the coaches. If they decide to bring one coach in, then where's the strategy? Is the strategy going to be on Test cricket or one day?
I've got a feeling my idea, I'd like to go a bit right field with it, and with Andrew Strauss's job is split it into two. I'd like to have one person managing the Test and one person managing white ball, and they can focus on that, and when they can have regular meetings, maybe every week, 2 weeks, what's going on, what have people seen. So you literally split it in two, because it's so different. You can't have this one person trying to then think, oh, this guy can leave however many balls outside off stump, he's got temperament. Oh, this guy is outside off stump, he can whack it for six over there, over cover. You need, I feel, two people at the top to make these decisions.
Chris, finally, now for your bit of punditry, I fear. Look ahead to Sri Lanka, white ball and red ball, West Indies, white ball and red ball, World Cup and the Ashes.
Okay, right, Sri Lanka. Test-wise, I feel, unfortunately, we are going to lose that Test series, because I don't think we have enough experience in there to pull through, because who was it? I think it was Saranga Lakmal last time round. He didn't bowl his first over, his first spell, till the 48th over in Sri Lanka. So, unfortunately, we don't have a good spinner, a top-class spinner. I think Harath could rip through our middle order, and our top order, to say the least. So I feel like we're going to lose the Test series. I think the one day is we have a little bit more of a chance. I still think we will win the one day series, although it'll be close. West Indies, that should be a stone bonker. We should beat the West Indies. It'll be embarrassing if we don't.
West Indies have been beaten this week in India by an innings and 482 runs.
If it was me, I'd drop Anderson and Broad for a rest.
Root said that he wanted their experience, whether or not they played, and I can see the sense in that, almost moving into a kind of coaching role. And very quickly then, Chris, never mind the Ashes for now, because Australia are a bit of a busted flush. Even Shane Warne said so in the paper this morning. So, World Cup chances?
They're there. One of the favourites. but I still believe we won't break our duck. I don't think we're.
Yeah, I think we're right.
I don't think we're consistent enough, and I think our bowling's.
I think we'll get to the final, but I think we won't.
I've got a feeling we're going to bottle out in the semis again.
Chris, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show one more time this year. We hope that wherever you are next year, you'll be able to visit from time to time. And gentlemen, we must move on. Welcome back to part two of On the Front Foot this Thursday evening. David J, this side of the desk. Tim, the other. You doing all right over there, sir?
Yes, all good, thank you, all good.
That's good. Well, let's get straight on with it, because we've had more different individual guests from Outwood, I think, Tim, than any other club locally. But Phil Yent is here this evening. Phil is the chap who kindly keeps me supplied with Outwood results on a Tuesday for the Wednesday show. Phil, a very good evening. Good evening to you. Welcome to Susie 103.4.
Good evening, David.
It's absolutely lovely to have you here. Now, let's begin. We've got Chris Jacobs over there, just come back from the US of A. Tell us as much as you can, given the doctrine of what's on tour stays on tour, about Outwood's recent jaunt to Hungary.
Yeah, we took 18 guys to Budapest, and we played three games, lost three games, one of them narrowly. We had an absolutely fabulous time, as you might expect, in Hungary. Budapest is a fabulous city, great weather, and our hosts looked after us a treat.
And how does it work out there? Is it outdoor artificial pitches?
Yes, it's an outdoor ground. It's down by the Danube. You don't actually see the Danube, but it was flooded by the Danube a couple of years ago. But it's a beautiful ground with a synthetic wicket. The facilities are a bit basic because it was flooded by the Danube a couple of years ago, but they've got eight teams that play off the one ground, divided into two divisions. Real mix of players. So we played a team that had Afghan in it, Sri Lankan, Indian, a couple of Hungarians, Australian. Real mix and real nice bunch, actually.
At the risk of repeating myself, I've got fairly close connections with the ICC World Cricket League through my Jersey connections, and I'm not quite sure how far up the European scale of things Hungary have reached, but it is astonishing how these lower nations, for want of a better word, have got the game thriving and expanding. I think it's brilliant. Tell us about, again, as much as you can, about off-field. What's the grub like in Hungary? What's the accommodation like?
We Airbnb'd, and very, very nice. We normally get hotels, but we just couldn't get 18 guys in one hotel. The food was excellent. We found some really great restaurants. The beer is quite cheap, so it was very good value.
Is that why you lost three games?
No, well, I can't really blame the first one on that, because we went straight into the game. But yeah, the other two weren't so good. But great city. You can stay up as late as you like. You'll always find something to do there. And we had a thoroughly entertaining time.
And a good standard of cricket.
Yes, they were very, very good. The tourists are not the strongest of Outwood sides, but we took a couple of first team guys, Matt Norman and George Stoyle, who are in our first 11, couple of second team players, and some good cricketers. The first game came down to the last ball. We lost off the last ball. They needed one run, and they got it. The second one was a bit of a drubbing. I won't tell you the scores. Third one was close again. It was a good standard. I mean, they can hit the ball, and they can catch, and they can bowl.
And so long as, good times had by all, that's really the essence of a tour, isn't it? And let me ask you, ballpark figure, please don't go into details. What does it cost the individual to do a trip like that?
Under 300.
And that's not a lot of money.
No, that's good value, isn't it?
So the accommodation would have been probably about £80 for the three or four nights. Flights are about £100, and then whatever you take as spending money. So it does represent good value.
And you had wives and girlfriends on tour, did you, as well?
No, we just take players on this particular tour. I know some clubs do take wives, but we tend to not for any particular reason other than we don't.
Mm. Fair enough.
Well, there's always the reason of team bonding, isn't there? I know that's in the loosest possible sense, especially if the beer is cheap.
Yes.
But, you know, talking to Andy Tharp about the Mogs wandering locally on the last show, and indeed their trips down to to the West Country and abroad, I think...
There's nothing better than a cricket tour, is there, really? I mean, I remember I've been on tour with Leatherhead Cricket Club, and it's great fun. We used to tour down in the Isle of Wight and places like that, and it doesn't matter where you go, it's just nice, as you say, you bond with the other players. It's just good fun, and it's always great to play different sides, and sometimes the games are good, sometimes they're not, but it's always good.
Yeah, and I mean, we have quite a strong sort of village ethic around the team. You know, it's quite strong bonding, so a lot of the guys that go you'll see on a day-to-day basis, so there's an awful lot of banter and taking the mick out of each other, so it is good fun.
Only the strong survive, but that's a necessary element of the whole thing, in my experience. I mean, I used to enjoy when we took the grammar school to unusual places. I mean, we went to Sandbach and Liverpool, we went good friends in Colchester, so we used to go to Essex as well and play at Enfield Grammar School on the way back. We did Shropshire, we did Cheltenham. I think it was really important to do that in the years in between the major tours that we used to run. Of course, you mentioned Matt Norman and George Stoyle, Phil. I mean, it's all Grenada and points west these days.
Yes,
but
yes.
My budget never really stretched to anything. Bearing in mind, I packed it in the year 2000, so it's a long time ago now. Let's look ahead, Phil, if we may, before we look back. What's on the outside agenda for the coming winter, bonding wise, training wise, Colts wise, women's cricket wise, and on the social circuit?
Yeah, well, it's very busy. We've got two indoor leagues starting shortly. The men start in a week's time, and they play at Oxford School, and the women play at Box Hill starting at the end of October. And that's just a small league. There's four teams in the men's and five in the women's. The women are undertaking their own sort of winter training. We've got a hard, they call it the Mooga, multi-use games area. And so they've got weekly training sessions on the Mooga during the winter. We have our nets will start in, I think, February, running into March. And that will be for the academy and for our first and second team players. So there's an awful lot going on as we prepare for next season. It never really stops, you know, at the end of the season when the game stops, all the preparation starts for the new season.
Do you keep the bar open throughout the winter?
No, our pavilion is a summer building only, really. Mm. So we've got another couple of socials there, and then we close it up in October because it gets too cold. There's no heating in it. So we close it up in October, take the nets down, pack everything away, and we open up next April, and then we kick off with a couple of socials, series of friendlies for our first and second 11, and then we're into the league season and the friendlies.
I'm interested that you talk about it never really stopping, and I think that applies to the players these days as much as it does really to ground maintenance and so on and so forth. I mean, Tim, there would be absolutely no way in which a highly talented, let's say, cricket and hockey player like in your time, Greg Lawson and Simon Highgate at school, there would be no way either of those two would be able to play two sports at university any longer.
No, that's right. It would be very difficult, and that's how things have evolved, I guess. Whether that's a good thing or not, well, I suppose it's good for the individual sport, but it's not good for the individual who can't play both of those.
Though it remains amateur in name, everything, I mean, school sport, heaven only knows, and there's an argument to be held about this, but everything is increasingly professionalised.
Well, even the costs of joining these clubs when you go into university, and I'd say this from knowledge, my daughter's just gone to university, and as an example, if you want to join the university hockey club in Exeter, it costs you £490.
Yeah.
Wow.
So how many of those clubs can you join? If you're serious about something, you'd pay it, but you laying that sort of money out, you have to be pretty serious about playing.
From memory, at New College all those years ago, and granted, not university cricket, not Blues cricket, but college cricket, I think you paid your match fee and your beer money, and there was no overall sub, but that is nearly 50 years ago.
I think
so
things just changed,
we'll draw a veil over that, perhaps. So a busy winter coming up for the club, Phil. And we've got Matt Camp coming in, who organises the Surrey Slam after 8 o'clock, and Outwood had huge success in the inaugural competition.
Yeah, it was a fabulous competition for us, and it's one of those things where when it starts, you're not quite sure what you're going to get from it, but our lads absolutely embraced it. They really threw themselves into it. They got the coloured clothing from the start. We fielded a team that had anything between 4 and 6 under 15s in it, and at the outset we thought, well, just go and enjoy it. But as we played some of the bigger teams, these guys were really, really good. These under 15s weren't phased. They found themselves into high pressure situations within matches, and they just took it all in their stride. And we went through our group stages with a clean sweep. We then played the regional semi and won that, and the regional final and won that. So we went to finals day with high hopes. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be. We came up against Spencer Spitfires, who won the competition. And actually, you know, we could have won that. We just didn't play as well as we had done. Bit of a shame, but you know, good on Spencer. They did a good job.
I suppose, you know, you did have the Llamas locally and one or two of the other bigger sides involved in the competition, but it strikes me, I mean, I know they're not high flyers in the way that they were 30 or 40 years ago, but it strikes me that Spencer are still quite a big London club to be in the Surrey Slam at all.
Huge. Their academy, I think, is over 1,000 children. Well, our academy is 50, 60 children. Yeah. So that gives you an idea of the size. And, of course, they're based up in Earlsfield.
I was going to say, playing at your ground or playing at their ground, the difference between playing at your... Did they play at your ground?
No, we didn't have them down our way.
No, I was going to say, that would have been very different for them coming to the nice rural sort of picturesque ground, wouldn't it?
Yes, so. I mean, if they find it, because, you know, we're quite tucked away.
Yes.
But when we hosted, I mean, the guys coming down, they absolutely love our ground, and of course you know we made a bit of a show of it. We put music on and we had coloured stumps with zinger bales.
Isn't it amazing how those sort of little innovations make such a difference for the youngsters when they see the sort of coloured stumps, the coloured kit, all that sort of stuff?
Oh,
it makes a huge difference, the kids wanting to actually play in it.
It does, and actually it brought the crowds
in.
So we were able to advertise it around the village and say, don't go to London to watch cricket,
come to us.
And our lads put on, I think we got 3 home games, they put on 3 high quality home games which came down to the last over. And with the music and the coloured clothing and the zinger bales, okay, not quite Surrey, but really, really good quality stuff. And a lot of them went away very impressed.
And you made a bit of money at the bar, did you?
Yeah, we did, and that wasn't the original. You just wanted to give people a good time, but actually people came, they hung around, we had a barbecue on, we had the bar open, and we did
it's quite
been a well
great, it's been a fantastic idea to get the Surrey Slam going. And as I say, we've got Matt Camp on later. We had him on at the start of the year, and the enthusiasm that Matt has for the tournament was so evident when he came in the first time.
You could just
see that he was so into it, and it almost felt a little bit like he couldn't sort of believe how popular it had become. I'm not sure he ever thought it would be as big as it is, but it's been massively successful.
Speaking to him on a number of occasions, absolutely bowled over by the response. He was expecting, you know, a reasonable turnout, but not 64 teams.
Yeah,
I think it was 62.
Tell me, Phil, did you find that any of the original purpose of the Slam was fulfilled at Outwood, given that, as you say, you've got an academy of 50 or 60? Did the competition attract anybody back into the club?
Not for us, it didn't. We only had one inquiry, which, when we followed up, didn't materialise into anything. I know other clubs did get people coming back. I guess what it did for us, it cemented the sort of the team bonding. So a lot of these Slam guys played in the first 11, and I think what it did for us was it allowed us to carry them through the season. In seasons past, we've perhaps struggled a bit for first team players. This season, we made a couple of finds during the winter, and actually the whole team just, you know, really cemented and gelled, and there was never any problem with team selection during the year. Well, in fact, the only problem was leaving people out.
Yeah. Now, of all these youngsters that John Hall's been telling us about, John's been in twice on the show, you're at the stage now, presumably, where some of these are really reaching young adulthood, so that they will be maintaining adult places as adults, assuming they stay around to do so. What's the next level like? What's the 14s, 13s down at that sort of age group coming through?
Yeah, we've, well, if we go right to the bottom and start coming back, the under 9s, very, very good turnout this summer. Very strong representation, always a full team, and they did very well in their league considering this was their introductory year to cricket. So they came up against some under 10 sides, and actually they did very well. We weren't able to get teams out in the sort of 10 and 11s and 12s. But next year we have high hopes that we will be able to. The under 9s will become under 10s, and we will be able to get sort of 12s and 13s out. Our under 15s were very, very strong. So not only were some of the players playing with the second 11 and John Hall, but they were also turning out for our under 15 side, and they were exceptionally good. They came, I think, third in their league, and it was just a question of a point here and there that actually didn't carry them over the line, but they were very, very good.
Any prospects, Phil, for outward thirds in the near future?
What we're doing next summer, we are looking to put in an under 15 development squad into the Surrey Development League.
Yeah. Yep.
So the idea is that you get your under 15s, you mix them with experienced players, first team players. And then you put them into a league, and there's about 8 games, I think. They're played on Sundays. So that's our next step for our 15s, because they did so well, and they as a team really, really bonded. So what we want to try and do is carry that through, keep them together as a unit. Because the thing around our first 11 now, it's the sort of our original academy generation. Mm. So Matt Norman and his guys is 5 or 6 of them, they kind of all still play together in our first 11, and they've come through the whole thing. And
it's like a core, isn't it, that goes through.
Yeah. And you go through periods where there's less of them around because they go to university, but they've all come back. They're all,
that's the crucial thing, isn't it, to get them back. And once you can get them back after university, you've probably got them then for several years. It's just that period, isn't it, when they go away to university.
Absolutely.
That try and make sure that they come back. So that's good.
So we want to hold the 15-year-olds and get them through. Yeah. Give them more cricket.
Well, as you said earlier on in the Surrey Slam as well, that's another way of getting the Colts in and getting them used to playing with adults and in a competitive environment where there's something at stake. So it's all good.
It's good.
So before we move on, Phil, to the actual raison d'être for you being here this evening, how are the prospects for the 2s in Division 6 and the 1s back where they belong at the top next season?
Our second 11 did exceptionally well. They went through the season, played 18 and won 13, which was really, really a good performance. Built on the back of our youngsters. Again, four or five of them played regularly every week, supported by John, his brother Keith, who was quite a find. He plays hockey, but we managed to get him for the summer. So they did exceptionally well. We think that they'll hold their place in Division 6. Wanted to get out of Division 7 because in the KCVL it's a bit of a mishmash. Some teams you play 3 times, some teams you don't play at all. So we wanted to get out, we wanted to get back into a regular home and away fixture against everyone. And we think that we'll carry our 15-year-olds with us. The difficulty is, of course, we go into the next year, they'll be doing their GCSEs, so you have to make allowances for that. But as we're planning at the moment, we think that we'll get through that and we'll keep them next year. They are a very keen bunch of 4 or 5, and we've got some good older players who want to play second 11 cricket and carry them through. First 11, again, played 18 games, won 13, a very, very good season for them. They're now in Division 1. Again, if we hold on to the sort of the the high that we had at the end of the season, and we can carry that momentum through. Again, we have high hopes that we'll put up a good showing in Division One. It is another level of standard up. It is quite a bit different. But you know, we've got some very, very good players. You've got Ashley Middleton, who's our keeper, best keeper by a country mile in any of the divisions, and actually the best batsman in terms of runs scored. He scored just shy of 1,000 league runs.
I was going to say, I was sitting here on a Wednesday afternoon with your results and reports, and if it wasn't 100 and odd, it was 90 odd. And
yes.
Of course, I went last Saturday morning when we were having a little chat on air trailing this show and called him Ashley Metcalf, who used to play for Yorkshire. But these things happen when you're live on air. Well, that's tremendous to know that he's been so successful. And presumably, Phil, that's as high as you go unless you start seeking a position with another league.
Yes, and that's tough for a club our size. Mm. You know, we would like to cement a place in Division One and push for league honours. We last won back at the beginning of the sort of the noughties, as it were, 2000 odd. And again, it was built that success was built around a nucleus of players who came, stuck around for a few years, enjoyed their cricket, enjoyed what Outwood had to offer. They kind of moved on, and we sort of then go through a bit of the doldrums, but we've got a real positive feel about it. Got some really, really good players, really enjoy what they're doing, and it's supported by the village. You know, there's a lot of players come from the village now.
That's key, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, and the club is just a nice place to go on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, or indeed on a Wednesday evening now. You know, the Wednesday evening slam stuff was brilliant for us.
Well, it's been absolutely excellent, Phil, to have you here, and yet again, Time's Winged Chariot is catching up with us. I'm going to ask Tim Bowling to present you now with the frame which is here in front of you over on that side, and this is quite simply our first award of On the Front Foot's Club of the Year. It's only a little plaque for the pavilion wall, but we're confining this award to those clubs who support us with regular reports, and in terms of your success in the slam and the two Saturday sides doing so well, there's absolutely no question about who our first recipient is going to be.
Well, we've been going for about 3 years now doing this show. I think it's the third year we've been doing this, but it's the first time we've ever presented this award, so congratulations. You were by far and away the team that we wanted to select for this particular award. It's been fantastic. You send us in all your reports. We've had various members from you over the season. So,
yeah.
Again, it's a little token. Hopefully you can put it in the pavilion.
Oh, yes.
But congratulations for being our team of the year.
And thank you very much. We're honoured to be the first recipients of it. Thank
Phil Yent from Outwood Cricket Club. Great pleasure to see you here tonight. And that's the first hour of two on our final On the Front Foot for this season of 2018. And a real pleasure to see Phil Yent from Outwood, who have done great things on the cricket field in the season now ended. Matt Camp is going to join us to talk about the Surrey Slam, and indeed to talk about white ball cricket at club level and international level. Welcome back to the second hour of two on this final On the Front Foot cricket chat show at Suzy 103.4 for the season of 2018. My name's David Jay. Tim Bowling is the other side of the panel. We're about to be joined by Matt Camp, the organiser of this year's inaugural and hugely successful Surrey Slam. Matt Camp from the Surrey Slam, it's lovely to have you back here on the end of what appears at any account to have been a highly successful enterprise.
Thank you for having me back. Yes, it's been a very busy but very enjoyable summer.
And tell us what the downsides were for the organiser before we go on to all the triumphs, because obviously triumph and disaster, two imposters, Kipling, all of that.
The biggest downside has been the fact that I've not bowled a ball all summer. Classic irony. This is made for people who haven't got a lot of time to play some cricket. and it rested me, unfortunately. But maybe next year when things are a little bit more settled.
Have you had reports from all of? I know it wasn't actually 64 clubs. One or two clubs fielded a couple of sides, but have you had some reports that the original intention was at least in part fulfilled? Did you attract people back into the game?
Yes. So we did a survey of all the clubs at the end, and so 1,200 players played in the competition at some point this year, but the big thing was that 240 of those were either coming back to the game lapsed or actually not really properly played the game in that sort of level before. So to hit that sort of 20%-ish mark of new players was fantastic, really pleasing.
So you ended up with something which, no names, no pack drill, but was relatively competitive at the top end, certainly by the time it got to group finals and so on and so forth. But you did achieve your recreational aims at the lower end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously there was the idea of getting getting new players in, but it wasn't just about that. It was about providing a bit more something for clubs to get hold of, which is great to hear from Phil earlier from Outwood and how they grasped it. And like Phil said, they didn't get any new players from it, and actually many people in this kind of swathe of the county didn't get many, but it had other benefits, and so I was very privileged to actually go down to Outwood twice this year and obviously saw them at finals day, and to see how they embraced it, what they laid on, how it brought their community together. You know, it put a bit of a tear to my eye at the time, to be honest. It really was something maybe I wasn't quite banking on, but so chuffed that it had happened.
If it's worth doing, well.
I mean, there's been no doubt whenever we've had over the season. I mean, I can't believe it was. I think it was back in April you were here last. Was it April we had you? I think it was either April or May. Anyway,
yeah,
it was a long time ago. And since then, we've had lots of guests in from different clubs, and it's amazing how many of them have been involved in the Surrey Slam, and how many of them have raved about how good it's been for the club, how it's brought people together. As you say, it's brought communities together. It's brought youngsters through. You know, it's brought new players into it. So by all accounts, from everybody we've spoken to, and we've spoken to a lot of people, it has been a huge success.
Well, that's great to hear, and because there's two sides of it. Yes, I'm sure we'll go into the whole thing about time that people have to play the game, but it's not just about that. It's actually the time that people are prepared to watch it. So, you know, if your families want to come down, are they really going to come down for 80 overs on a Sunday? Probably not, but they will come down for 2.5 hours on a night where they can get a bit of grub from the barbecue, the odd pint or two, and it's been fantastic to see so many clubs actually achieve that, be it on a Friday night or Wednesday night. Didn't seem to matter.
And clearly everything got played in the scheduled time, and you were able to move things forward as you wanted to. How did the finals day go? Because we've not asked Outwood about that.
Well, finals day, so we had that in, when was it, the Bank Holiday Monday at Beddington. We wanted to get a pitch that had a ground that had two pitches, so it wasn't a really elongated day. So we had Valley End versus Effingham in one final, and we had semi-final, and we had Outwood against Spencer in the other. Effingham made a good job on Valley End. That wasn't particularly competitive semi-finals, to be honest, which much to my surprise, as it goes. But the Outwood Spencer semi-final was a really good game, and it was just taken away from Outwood at the end. But on another day, and I think Phil said this, that they could have really
As Phil said, considering they were playing a club like Spencer, who have a huge sort of infrastructure, if you like, compared to Outwoods, who are a village side. They did amazingly well to you know, make the game competitive.
Yeah, and I can see how there can be that perception that how, you know, they were playing Spencer's a massive club. But this is why the eligibility rules are in the competition, to ensure that we kind of get that level playing field. So it's fantastic to see a game like that against, like you said, a big club and a village club. But it was so close that
it proves the rules work, doesn't it? That it's been set up so that any club can get to, as long as they're competitive and they want to win it, they can get towards the latter stages and have a good chance of winning the whole thing.
Absolutely, and it was pleasing to see the teams that had got to the latter stages. There were three sort of sizeable clubs in the finals day, but in the latter stages of each region, there were definitely the likes of Outwood in the other regions as well.
And if Effingham striped up Valley End in the semi, it sounds as though Spencer Spitfires thoroughly deserved to win the competition.
They definitely were the better side on the day, yeah. But they didn't get through their region without a few scrapes. So, you know, we see this in any level of cricket, don't we? And, you know, it's always been England's downfall at certain competitions where you're going with all form, but on the day, so anything can happen. And Spencer, to be fair to them, turned up on the day and put in two really
good. It'd be interesting to see next season whether Spencer are still there or thereabouts on finals day. That, I think that will be interesting to see how it sort of evolves next year.
I think there's a number of teams that went into it maybe not quite realising how competitive it could possibly get. I think a good example is the is this region's final, where Outwood turned over Reigate Priory very easily. I officiated in that game, and maybe it's a bit unfair, but it felt like Reigate Priory turned up thinking it was going to be a bit easy. And they got caught.
Yeah,
well, you're talking about the one local club and the senior local club which steadfastly and repeatedly refuses to have anything to do with this cricket show. I fail to understand it.
That's a shame.
But, yeah, but there we are. And I bet Merstham looked after you on that evening. They're an up and coming club.
They did, and bless them. They've had some terrible, you know, we've blessed with some halcyon weather, haven't we? But it really caused Merstham some problems this year with their ground. But bless them, they could easily have just turned around and said, you know what, we can't do this with all the work they had to have done, but they hosted us that day, did a really good job, had a really good crowd out that night. It was fantastic weather, and really good performance from Outwood that night.
When you were talking about the finals day just now, I was pondering on my qualifications, dubious qualifications for doing this show, Tim. What I can say is that I've played at Outwood, at Effingham, at Valley End, at Beddington and at Spencer in my time.
Yeah,
so,
I think I've played at most of those grounds as well. Beddington always, I always remember Beddington because it always felt that the dressing rooms always seemed a little bit dark and dingy inside. They've probably changed since I last played there, but I always remember it was a little bit dark down at Beddington. But I think I've played at most of those grounds.
I've got a few anecdotes, maybe if we do a Christmas special or whatever. My abiding memory of Spencer is having lunch with Tony Cozier, bless him, he's gone now, on one side. I was playing for Bill Frindle against Spencer. Tony Cozier on one side, you know, amazing to have one of the premier commentators of the day, and Butch White of Hampshire, and briefly for England on an India tour in 1961. And in the course of that lunch, we discovered that a relative of Butch White's founded the Gooder Prize for Mathematics at the Grammar School in
Reigate.
It's a very
small world,
very
isn't it?
Small world.
Yeah.
So, Matt, same again next year, 64, or...?
No, I expected to be more.
Did you have a wait? You had a waiting list this season, did you?
No, not a waiting list.
So you got
list.
Everybody.
We had to cut it at some point because getting fixtures out and everything.
Yeah.
So there were teams that came a little bit late, and we did have to kind of say no. But we've been in conversations with various clubs over the summer because they've seen what neighbouring team the clubs have been up to and kind of thought, well, other piece of that, thank you very much. So look, my quiet target for this year in the midweek competition is 80. It'd be nice to hit that, but if it's 64 again, that's fine, that's still a good number. But it won't just be midweek next year. We're looking at doing a Sunday one because there appears to be this
as you mean as separate to the midweek tournament. So have two different tournaments,
yeah, separate competition.
Okay,
because there is this apparent desire to have a shorter form on a Sunday. So all I've said is, okay, well, we'll put it out there and we'll see if clubs want to take it up, and we'll do it'll be the same rules, it'll be set at the same sort of level of player, and we'll see what takes off. It's early days of that in terms of clubs getting involved, but it will be there. And then really pleasingly is there'll be the Women's Slam next year as well, which actually will be a formal part of the Surrey pyramid of women's cricket.
I was going to ask you about that. Can you? I've got the poster in front of me. We've had one or two slightly conflicting reports of how the women's competition might operate. Clearly, you're the man who can give us chapter and verse.
Well, so the Surrey Slam is for the women will be at the lower level of the Surrey pyramid, but it will be, in essence, it will be an eight-a-side competition, 16 overs. But there will be the ability, if teams are able to have more women out, that they can go up to 11-a-side if they want to in 20 overs. There'll be that flexibility, because at the end of the day, we are just looking to get people playing cricket. It's not going to be that hard and fast to stop people playing just for the sake of it. But it will also be, there will be sort of fixture windows of, so there'll be, I think, so at the moment, it's early days, but it'll be a mixture of weekends and midweek.
Okay, and of course there has to be a contingency plan for 2019 being a not so long and not so hot summer. You have been blessed with that.
Absolutely, yeah. We've only really had in the main season, we only had 1 week that was a problem. But the point was, all those fixtures had a fortnight window to play in. So even though that 1 week gave us grief, there was already a reserve date in place. And that was one of the key things that has been a bit of a struggle with some teams to get their head around. But maybe it'll prove its worth even more next year. But the key thing is, in advance, well in advance, you have those two dates fixed, so that if one gets rained off, everyone knows immediately when they're going to reconvene. It's not a case of on that night, oh, let's see if we can pull a date together between 22 players, which is never going to happen.
It sounds absolutely brilliant, and hats off, you've done a marvellous job. I mean, this is an inaugural tournament, for goodness sake, Tim, and pretty much hitch-free, weather or no weather. Yeah. I mean, it's been wonderful, and I'm glad that, Here Come the Girls means what it says. We've chatted numerous times on the show since you were in earlier in the season, Matt, and to me, one of the best things all year is the expansion of the KSL in particular, and women's cricket on Sky Sports in general. It's a breath of fresh air because it's different.
Yeah, it is indeed, and it's something that's actually quite close to me. With I've got a 7-year-old daughter who plays in the All Stars scheme, so she's really into women's cricket. We went to the finals day, Key League finals day last year, which was on a Friday night, bemusingly. And yes, it's ironic really that I scheduled my finals day on the same day as the Kia Super League finals day this year, which will not happen next year, because yes, my daughter gave me a bit of grief for that, particularly as Surrey won it.
Well done, the Surrey Stars. And yeah. Amy Grant from Reigate Priory was on the bench. Yeah. She didn't get on the field, but she was on the bench, and it was a brilliant day. I was pretty much washed out Bank Holiday Monday, so I just sat on the sofa and watched it. I entertained ideas of coming up to Beddington, but I thought, no, you're too old, let that be. I'm going to open this out just a little bit now. Matt, before I do, is there anything else you want or need to tell us about the Surrey Slam 2018 or 19? Don't feel you have to.
No, but I would like to take the opportunity to thank anybody who was involved this year, because it doesn't work. I can do as much as I can, but it doesn't work if the clubs don't embrace it, if the players don't embrace it. And, you know, they've really taken it on and played it at such a level that it's getting other clubs wanting to get a piece of it. If it was just all kind of a bit lackadaisical and a bit of a hit, you know, like a Sunday hit, I don't think we'd get the desire for more clubs to get involved. So hopefully it'll get bigger, and talking out of this region, it might get bigger beyond this county as well. It's going to go into Cornwall next year. I'm talking with Lancashire in 2 weeks' time, and Sussex to come as well, maybe. So this could be pretty busy.
I'm interested that you should be thinking in those terms of nationwide expansion. Let me throw this open now. Having just said, on behalf of everybody who has been involved through the medium of Susie Radio tonight, well done on an absolutely fantastic job. Were I wearing my hat, I'd take it off to you.
Thank you.
But let's just open this out, because it seems to me, Tim, you are an implacable hater of anything shorter than 40 overs, I know, and the white ball and all the rest of it. But it seems to me that what we're dealing with here is a format which has now been organised, recognised and recognisable for the best part of 20 years. And indeed, as we said, I'm sure when you were here before, Matt, you know, I mean, I used to play it outward in 20 over thrashes for the school staff side of a midsummer evening and thoroughly enjoy it. Although it was played properly in those days, one of those socking great bats and hit it here, there and everywhere. But that said, it just seems to me you've got this recognised and recognisable product which has become part of the national cricketing psyche. Can you tell me why on earth we need to mess about with this 100 competition other than for something different? Given that if the intention of the 100 is to attract a new audience, what you'll be attracting them to will not be cricket in any recognisable shape or form.
It bemuses me, because what you just said there is, I can't believe the idea is to get get the new audience, but just keep them in that 100 bubble. I can't believe that. Sure, we want to get them more into, will it be up to Test cricket, you know, going up through the lengths, whatever it is. So it does seem odd to do that. I think, for me, when it started, amazingly, in 2003, it's that long ago now, you know, when the T20 competition started in this country, we saw the hit, we saw the packed audiences, you know, and it's kind of turned into, I'm having gone to the Oval a fair few times over the last years, it's turned into a bit of a beer fest, unfortunately. And funny enough, I was talking to someone just the other day about, who'd been out and seen a number of Big Bash games in Australia, and I was curious to know what the difference was. And the Big Bash is absolutely marketed at families. It's not a beer fest on a Friday night. I mean, don't get me wrong, there will be some, but not in the way it's kind of turned into here. And I just felt, actually, maybe really we've got the package there, we've got something there that we could just retarget it a little bit rather than go with something completely new. We already know we've got a summer that is absolutely ram-packed with different brands of cricket and trying to squeeze that in. And I struggle to see how we're going to manage to squeeze this one in as well. Yeah, I just think maybe we could just do better with what we already got.
The Oval, I suppose, Tim, accommodates those who've only got to walk across Vauxhall Bridge, and really moulds itself thereby to the Friday night city drinking culture, of which I know you're not a part, because you're always hightailing it back to leafy Surrey. But I was absolutely horrified the first time Joey Benjamin got us a bundle of tickets to go and sit in what was the Peter May stand and watch Kent play Surrey under the lights. And I tried to sit there and watch Rob Key and Joe Denley, who put on 100 for the first wicket in about 10 overs, and I should think I was the only person in the ground watching the cricket. I don't think that presentation on television helps necessarily. I love the pod and the way that they get down close to the action and so on, but when TV producers start concentrating on the beer snakes rather than the cricket, I wonder if the values there are quite right.
It's interesting what you said, Matt, about the fact that the Big Bash is family orientated. I didn't really know that, and maybe that's to the sort of detriment of the fact that I guess there is a sort of drinking culture anyway in this country. Maybe, I mean, I guess there is in Australia as well, but the fact that it has become that in this country is a little sad. I think the problem with the 100 is that it seems to me it's a political project that the ECB have put together to try and placate the counties, because they knew they couldn't bring in this franchise system as exactly the same as the county system. Otherwise, you'd have two products, and how do you differentiate between them? Because you've got a T20 tournament for the cities, and you've got a T20 tournament for the counties. So the only way the reason they've done it is to try and differentiate those two particular brand, so that you have a city franchise a city franchise tournament which is run under different rules. And to try and mess around and say, I think they said, oh well, this will bring more girls into the game. I don't understand the mentality as to why it would. This will bring other new people into the game. Again, I don't see why. And that's why it frustrates me. David's right. I'm not a fan of T20 cricket at international level. I think for Surrey Slam and for local cricket, it's brilliant. And you've heard us talk about it. I think it's been fantastic what you've done and what has happened with T20 cricket. Cricket has been dying at a local level. T20 cricket is a short form. It will bring people back into the game and bring those lapsed people back in. I don't personally think they should play T20 at international level at all. I think the highest it should be at the sort of first class level, if you like. There's plenty of leagues around the world which are glamorous enough to almost replicate international cricket. Sometimes with the ECB, when they make these sorts of decisions, it baffles me why we would need 100 tournament.
Someone taking fairly clear aim at Colin Graves said that English cricket ought not to be run like a cheap jack supermarket.
Yeah, well, exactly. And it's just frustrating. You know, we saw the last, I mean, I know it was different, but we look at the last game of the county cricket season with Surrey. How exciting was that? For the first time, people were switching on and there wasn't even a title at stake. It was just to see if Surrey could remain undefeated. But what a game it became.
Let's talk about that after the bottom of the hour, if we may. We have a T20 expert with us. Last question, Matt, because as we keep saying on this show, time flies by and the wheels go around very, very fast. But how do you see, we mentioned the women's game earlier, how do you see England women going on in the world T20, and how do you view poor Sarah Taylor's latest mishaps?
Well, I think the women's squad is in a bit of transition. There's some fantastic young players coming in. I was very privileged to hear Heather Knight talk about it at Lord's the other day. And, so I think she recognises herself that they're probably not favourites going into this one. But, as we said before, that doesn't necessarily mean anything in a shorter format. It's in a tricky part of the world to perform as well as English cricketers. But they... You know, it's a fantastic series this summer, the Tri Nations series. Great idea to have two games on the one day. And it's actually really exciting watching the likes of Bryony Smith and that come into the England squad. And yes, I think there's a couple of years of transition, but you can say they're doing it the right way. It's almost happened straight away after winning the World Cup last year. Right, we've got 4 years to... There are certain guys there like Jenny Gunn and that are going to... probably just peter away now, you know, not going to be there in 4 years' time. So they've grasped it, and now we're bringing the young blood in now. So let's expect the fact that this year, maybe not, but they're definitely building for 3 years' time.
Certainly, and it was really very, very enjoyable, and it was good to see Nat Siver come into her own on that finals day, because she'd had a bit of a checkered time. It must be wonderful for the youngsters. We talked about the girl from Reigate Priory. It must be wonderful to be playing with those three South African internationals and picking their brains, and Smriti Mandana down at the Western Storm, you know. I mean, they were half the side when she was... recalled to India, weren't they? But absolutely splendid, and I think one or two of those you've mentioned coming through, like Katie George with her left arm over and so on. Let's hope that it's successful. Of course, it's not so very long since they've been out there. Mark Butcher was out there with them, wasn't he, on one of the Sky Sports I think it was the qualifying round.
Yes.
For the last World Cup. So they have been in West Indies. We're going to have to wrap up, Matt. We could go on talking forever. It's been a tremendous pleasure to have you back with us. We're delighted that your competition has gone so unbelievably well, and you will come back and see us next season, won't you?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Hello, good evening. My name's David Jay. Welcome back to the last part of our final On the Front Foot for this season of 2018. Chris Jacobs is still here, so he's come up to our third microphone. Tim and I will wrap things up when it gets to about 10 to the hour, but I've got a couple more things on the desk that I really have been wanting to talk about along the way, and we haven't got round to. So first, Tim, I'd like to recommend a book to you that we touched upon in one show earlier. This is Stephen Fay and David Kynaston, and the title is Arlott Swanton and the Soul of English Cricket. And it is in fact a social history rather than just a rehash, because obviously Swanton is a finite subject. Arlott, who retired nearly 40 years ago, for heaven's sake, and there's Chris telling us, you know, that he wasn't even born 20 odd years ago. I was teasing Chris earlier on about Trevor Bailey. I was saying this afternoon, and I reckon Trevor Bailey was the best captain England never had.
I was like, who?
and who else were we talking about? Who did you mention? I can't think who it was. Somebody. Oh, Shane Warne, of course.
That was it, yeah.
Shane Warne, the other book, which we'll come on to in a second. But this really, it strikes a chord with me, because Michael Henderson makes the point, and I don't think I can find it here now, but Michael Henderson makes the point that Swanton may have been respected, but Arlott was loved.
Yeah.
And sometime on one of these shows, if I can get them digitised, we ought to have one or two of John Arlott's commentaries, because an art form, an absolute art form.
Well, I would imagine there's probably quite a few youngsters who have not heard John Arlott.
Absolutely not. And why should they? Yeah. Things move on. But Michael Henderson's view is that John Arlott was the cricket commentator without compare. Brian Johnston used to say that Arlott's accent went along with bat oil and the smell of new mown grass at the end of April for the start of the season, and I certainly felt like that. So if anybody wants a winter read, it's published by Bloomsbury. Stephen Fay and David Kynaston, Arlott Swanton and the Soul of English Cricket. Now, I can't tell you very much about Shane Warne's book. It's called No Spin, and an article in the paper this morning, this is his latest, and he's been over here this week publicising it. He gave a lecture at the Oval, or an evening with at the Oval earlier on, and I said to you, Tim, the one that interested me, apart from Chris, the fact that, as we were discussing earlier today, Shane Warne is suggesting that it might be a good idea to remove the English captaincy from Joe Root.
Yeah, that was a... I still think it's a very strange decision. He was mentioning it earlier, saying how Joss Butler should take the captaincy, but as me and David were speaking earlier about it, with Joss Butler, he's already... If Bairstow has now relinquished the gloves, although he still wants to compete for the gloves, I wouldn't let him have the wicket-keeping gloves.
He hasn't relinquished them in the one day, but not in the test.
Because of injury, but you've seen how Butler's now performed in the test arena. If someone plays well, you can't take something away from them.
No.
If they've done it on merit. Fair enough, if he's injured, he can't help it, and he's lost it on an injury rather than bad performance. Because, yeah, he's come along with the gloves over the last few years, Bairstow.
But then, Joe, you could take the captaincy away from Joe Root, but have we gone down that route now, excuse the pun, where we're just picking the best batsman as the captain of England? That's what worries me.
Yeah,
I think we've got into that mindset.
I think that's a mindset that's going around a lot at the moment, because when would you say was the last international test bowler that was the captain? Like, predominantly a bowler.
Yeah.
Not a batsman, because you've got Kohli, who's captain, formerly Steve Smith, now Tim Payne. Is it Kane Williamson?
Yeah, but the problem with bowlers being captain is it's very difficult often for a bowler, whether he bowls himself too much, whether he bowls himself not enough, whether he takes himself off, puts himself back on. There is that danger, but you don't have to pick your best batsman. You can pick a player in the side who has a tactical brain.
Yeah, that's leadership.
Yeah, leadership, exactly. And the danger with having Root as captain is that we're just trying to go down that route. It was the same reason that Alastair Cook, we spoke about Alastair Cook earlier, phenomenal batsman. As you quite rightly said, Chris, we'll probably never see the like of him again in an England jersey. Amazing record, amazing mental strength. Was he a good captain? I don't think he was a good captain at all. I think it's debatable. I think he was selected because Strauss was such a good captain.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Michael Vaughan was such a good captain.
You've got that double-edged sword there, right there, that Strauss was a good captain, but he was a very good batsman at the same time. The difference with Michael Vaughan was a great captain, but his batting dropped off when he became the captain.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, it was interesting yesterday morning when the rain was coming down cats and dogs in, was it Dambulla, wherever the match was,
Dambulla,
in Sri Lanka. And, used to love TMS in the old days when it rained, but Nick Knight and Mike Atherton and Jamie Foster, who's going to be a good pundit, he's got a bit of the Rob Key everyman about him, and he's very articulate. But Nick Knight was talking to Michael Atherton about captaincy, and Ath made the point that in 2018 or 2019, the sainted J.M. Brearley would get nowhere near the England Lions, never mind the England first team, because what you've just described, being the best captain in the country, is no longer sufficient. No. You have to be worth your place in the side.
I mean, I guess that's true, again, as well, for wicketkeepers. You know, the best wicketkeeper might not necessarily get anywhere near the side if he's not a particularly great batsman. James Foster was a fantastic wicketkeeper, and ironically was a good batsman as well.
He was
an amazing keeper. He briefly appeared for England.
He didn't get his chance, because you saw the players we had at the time. We had Geraint Jones at the back end of his career.
Yeah.
You had
Matt Pryor and Chris Reid.
That was the problem with Chris Reid there. He was a great glove man, but his batting for test level was
You're quite right, David. With the captaincy, you know, somebody like Mike Brearley would not have got near that England side. How different? Well, we know how different it would have been, because at the start of that 81 series, England were in a mess. They had a captain who was a fantastic player in Ian Botham, but not a good captain. So we were getting absolutely stuffed in the first part of that series, and then they bring Mike Brearley back, whose average was probably dreadful. That's, I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but I imagine it was pretty dreadful.
Pretty poor, to be fair, to say the least. Yeah.
The whole thing changed round.
Let me stop you there. We need to go back to Shane Warne as well, but an article from last month in the paper. Botham goes into bat with his big-hitting Aussies. Sir Ian Botham has instituted a new range of wines from Down Under, which will be marketed under his own name. Flamboyant batsman and as a drinker, his taste is for flavours that are big and bold. He likes Spanish reds from Rioja and Ribera del Duero, Montes Purple Angel from Chile, and Cabernet Sauvignon, as long as it's from Australia. Always an interesting debate with Bob Willis, because he's a Shiraz man. So this is apparently going to be in the shops, and the top of the range is £42 a bottle.
Wow.
Ooh, so
wow.
That was the other bit and bob that I had, along with the two books.
I mean, Botham was always a big wine fan, even back in the days when he was playing, along with David Gower. And we were talking about cricket books. There was the cricket book written by Phil Edmonds' wife, Frances Edmonds. She wrote two books back in the 80s, one about the 1984 Caribbean tour and one about the 86-87 Australian tour, which was far more successful. And the latter book was called Cricket 4X Cricket. And within that, there's lots of mention of wine, of vineyards, of Botham and Gower going off to sample wine. And obviously back in those days, there were still rest days back in those days.
Yeah.
So the propensity for Gower and Botham to both consume wine was clear even back then. And Frances Edmonds does mention it often in that particular book. So I'm not surprised that Botham has finally got his own vineyard and he's producing his own wine.
Well, with Jeff Merrill, isn't it, the Australian winemaker, there's been Botham Merrill Willis wine on the market ever since those days. But this is a new enterprise for him. Shane Warne's book, which I'm sure will be an interesting read, Best Captain, I'm absolutely with you, Chris, all the way, Best Captain Australia Never Had. And the anecdote I was telling Tim off air earlier that made me smile was the way in which he clearly has no time whatsoever for Stephen Waugh. And he quoted as a reason for that the fact that if five of them went out and the bill was $100 and they split it $20 each, Steve Waugh would say, hang on, I only had the dish that was $11.50.
He's one of those.
That's awful.
He's one of those.
Awful.
So Shane Warne's latest, No Spin. Now, I'm going to go tracking off into something which is history even for you, Tim, but I think it would be wrong to let 2018 pass without just reflecting on the fact that this is the 50th anniversary of the Dolivera affair. And if people out there don't know, Basil Dolivera was dropped from the England team allegedly for problems on tour in West Indies the previous winter, 1967-8, and no doubt Basil liked a sherbet or 17. But there was obviously looming the tour to South Africa and the fact that Dolivera was a Cape coloured who had been got over here thanks to the offices of dear old John Arlott again. They started playing for Middleton in the Lancashire Leagues. And one thing led to another. Roger Prideaux of Kent withdrew from the final test at the Oval. Basil scored 158 and the rest is history. And of course he was then left out of the South Africa touring party. Tommy Cartwright developed an injury and dropped out. Basil was selected, and the South African Premier John Forster cancelled the tour with the famous remark that the team as constituted now is not the team of the MCC, it's the team of the anti-apartheid movement. And it was quite a thing, because speaking from my own experience, I was 17 at the time, I knew absolutely nothing. And we were brought up, you know, for Queen and Country, Empire and Commonwealth, and you assumed that the authorities were always right. Knew nothing of apartheid. My mother had worked for a South African businessman in London in the 50s. One way and another, he just thought, well, the establishment must be right. The, you know, no politics mixed with sport. The tour must go ahead somehow. But it didn't, and it wasn't. And South Africa were estranged until 1992. And if anybody, whether he liked to drink or not, if anybody ever conducted himself with utter dignity, it was Basil D'Oliveira throughout that entire carry-on. And it really was a carry-on. You can read all about it in various books. Peter Oborn wrote a book about it about 10 years ago. Simon Wilde has written a new book about it now for the 50th anniversary. It probably doesn't mean very much to either of you, but it was a seminal moment.
Well, it was slightly, it was about 2 or 3 years before I was born. Yeah, yeah. However, the ramifications and repercussions of what happened, I was well aware of when I was growing up. I mean, I remember as a child the rebel tours that went to South Africa and all the controversy around those particular tours, because South Africa had been excluded from sport, I guess as a direct result of the Basil D'Oliveira affair. So it had, whilst I was growing up and all the cricket I used to follow, it did have a big impact on everything that was going on then. But as you say, it's incredible to think that was 50 years ago. That's amazing, really.
And I'll tell you a story. 17 years old, in between lower and upper sixth, bored out of my brain in the last week of August 1968. And I sat down and I ruled myself a big, I don't know, it might have been A3 size or whatever it was in those days, imperial measures. I actually ruled myself up a do-it-yourself scorebook, and I scored every ball of that match off the television. Yeah. John Edrich made 164 going in first, and then Basil made this 158, and the rest is history. But extraordinary days. Only just beginning, you know, Lindsay Anderson's film If is 1960. When the CCF got on the roof of the public school and shot everybody's speech day and so on and so forth. And really and truly, we were so naive, we were so wet behind the ears, almost beyond belief. Very briefly, because you touched on it earlier, and you'll have been back home before this came about. What an amazing climactic game, as you said, Tim, the result was immaterial, but what an amazing game at the Oval between Surrey and Essex. Who needs T20 when there's county championship cricket like that?
It was incredible, and I think it was one of the few times that I've eagerly sort of tuned into county championship. I guess there were loads of people doing it. Sky Sports were covering it and did a brilliant job, and the way the game ebbed and flowed, it just seemed beyond comprehension that Surrey could get back into the actual game, having been bowled out so quickly in the first inning.
67 all
out. And then, you know, I think to be that far behind and come back and actually almost win it, and in the very last sort of throw of the game, you could see the passion for both sides. It was getting really heated for a game which had really nothing riding on it.
No, it hadn't, apart from pride, obviously.
Yeah. And the players, I mean, I think it was Dernbach that barged into one of the other opposing players, and there was all this sort of stuff going on. It was a really exciting game in the end.
And it just signifies the importance of what Morny Morkel's done for Surrey this season.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Nipping 3-4 wickets in like half an hour, just trying to push for victory. But I think that game, although there was like hundreds for Ollie Pope and a few of the other youngsters performed, it still has a big sentiment of how experienced old head cricketers are needed in county championship sides. The likes of Morny Morkel, Dean Elgar, and in that situation, when you've got wickets falling around you, if you've got a man of Ryan Tendiscarta's experience in the middle and scoring a 50 when they're chasing 132.
Yeah.
I was sitting here trying to do a radio show, a music show. I'd got the scorecard on the screen on my right hand side. I'd got Tim, who was watching it on a stream, texting me every 5 minutes. And really, having seen the 67 all out on the first morning, and let's be honest, a little bit of Rory Burns, we always bat hubris, because it was the end of September, and you might have thought, well, hang on a minute, you know, we've got Jade Dernbach, we've got whatever, and so they were rolled over. But what a phenomenal match, spread out over 4 days, and a decent crowd as well when the word got round, you know, and perfect weather at the end of September. I mean, it was just a brilliant...
The cricketing gods all got together, and it was perfect alignment, wasn't it, really?
And there's something to say that nobody ever has complete control of what's going to happen in cricket and on a cricket field, because shame it was that Surrey weren't able to defend their unbeaten record up to that point, but to come within one wicket of that, and Chris, in the course of all that toing and froing here in the studio and trying to keep the show going, I did text back to Tim, they've got to get Tendulkar out, and they didn't.
That was crucial, wasn't it, in the end?
So there it was, and Sussex, a bit like Reigate Priory, blew up at the final furlong, and Kent snuck past, and I think, you know, with hindsight, Kent and Warwickshire probably were the two best sides in Division 2, but it's a shame, because I've got a feeling that Hove needs Division 1 cricket.
Yeah, that was a real shame, that, because Sussex looked like they could well do that throughout the season, and then right at the end, as you say, Warwickshire and Kent ended up first and second, and Sussex finished in as third place. So it was a real shame for Sussex, that.
But a beautiful summer, and not a bad little batch of county championship cricket, really and truly. Why they should want to cut it back is beyond me, but anyway, that's probably for another day again. Chris, thanks ever so much for contributing to a bit of further discussion here. We could obviously go on all night, but thank you, and as I said a while back, let's hope that we shall meet again
thank
on
you.
This show.
You're welcome, as always, guys.
Tim, I suppose we can look back with a reasonable degree of satisfaction on the front foot in 2018.
I think we've had some absolutely great guests come in, and as we said earlier on off air, you know, we invite a lot of these guys come on and maybe have never been on air before, and we've never had a single guest who struggled to chat and to come across as being eloquent and erudite. And I think it's testament maybe to the actual game itself that it seems to instill this ability to talk about the game passionately. And we've had some really varied guests this year. We had Crispin Blunt MP came on, we had Chris Tavaray, the England Test batsman, we've had various clubs, Matt Camp, you know, it's been brilliant, some of the guests we've had.
And all we ever really do is scratch at surfaces within the context of a 2-hour show.
Well, that isn't it amazing, we both do lots of prep for the show, and I try and get notes together to and I sit here every program we do, I sit here with a pile of notes, and I probably refer to them twice if I'm lucky.
Never use it, but that's the old adage, isn't it? Fail to prepare, prepare to fail.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's absolutely vital. If somebody were, heaven forfend, but if somebody were to clam up or whatever,
yes, exactly.
You never know. But yes, you're absolutely right, and I don't think it is just about being good talkers, because there is the added pressure, albeit it's our little jukebox in a shed, but there is the added pressure of being in a live radio studio. I hope that we between us have managed to acquire the skill of putting people at their ease.
Well, you said it before, I think we try and make people believe that we're just sitting at the bar in the clubhouse having a chat after the match about various topics, and when people view it through that sort of lens, it makes it much easier just to sit here and chat about different things, especially about their own clubs or whatever it is that their speciality is.
That's right. I thought it was interesting to talk to Crispin Blunt, who, albeit a public figure, visibly relaxed through his 20 minutes so.
Yeah, and he made a big effort to be here, to be fair. He could easily have not come because he was at a meeting before, and he was a little bit late because he'd been delayed at this previous meeting. He could quite easily have said, I'm really sorry, I can't make it, and we would have said, okay, fair enough, you're an MP, we understand. But he got here late. He texted me during the show to say, I'm running late, is it okay if I still come? And when he came into the actual studio, you could see, as you say, he visibly relaxed, and he was friendly, and he was wanting to chat about cricket. It was really nice to see.
And something different, because we didn't just talk about Lords and Commons, did we? We talked about his time in the British Army of the Rhine. And touring and organising cricket. I think he probably had a fairly easy ride in terms of what the British Army was up to at that particular stage.
Yes, I think he probably caught it in between when they were maybe in certain conflicts. But he was very enthusiastic about his whole career, wasn't he? You know, it was good. It was lovely to. It was nice that he came in as well,
and to be able to sit behind this microphone and ask Chris Tavares what it was like at the other end throughout Ian Botham's 118 that Saturday afternoon at Old Trafford.
I sat here spellbound, and I think that was the one show when I just sat here listening to what he had to say, having been so enthused by that particular series as a 10-year-old. To sit here and listen to one of the protagonists actually give his description, his unique description of what it was like to bat at the other end when Botham was doing that, was amazing. I just sat here totally spellbound.
And Tav was, of course, somebody who, like Kenny Barrington before him, unlike Geoffrey Boycott, reined in his natural instincts to do a job for
England. What a lovely chap he was, wasn't he?
Oh, he was a very fine schoolmaster indeed, outstanding master in charge of cricket, and not a bad player, but he reined himself in. There's no question of
that. He knew the job he had to do, and he did it, didn't he?
As a schoolboy, he was a free-flowing attacking batsman, and but yes, a really lovely chap. And he came and had a jar up the road in the garden afterwards, and we had a natter. And aren't we lucky as well, not just with Chris sitting next to you, but with Jim Grant?
Yes, another good pundit.
And we're hopeful that Andy Tharp is going to join the punditry team next year, because that, I think, would be a good thing to encourage.
Exactly.
Rather than just you and me banging on about the same old...
I tell you what, we are starting to extend our coverage. Chris mentioned earlier about in the United States. We've just had Maximum Cricket are listening to us from the United States. So they've just followed us on Twitter. So it just shows you that the coverage of the game is now going global.
And, of course, in the week, not apropos of cricket, but... quite remarkably, we had Surrey and White Rock Twitter account from British Columbia, just south of Vancouver, and Semi Amu Senior Secondary School in White Rock was Reigate Grammar School's closest set of rugby compadres all the years that they went over there for tour. And if I have one regret among many, it's that I always wanted to take a cricket tour to Vancouver and play a game on the Brockton Oval in Stanley Park, and unfortunately that slipped Both Donald Bradman and Geoffrey Boycott said it was the most beautiful ground they'd ever been to.
Amazing.
It is quite extraordinary. It's on a sort of forest-bound promontory where Stanley Park juts out into the northern inlet just down below the First Narrows Bridge, and you've got the three mountains, Grouse and Seymour and whatever the other one's called, the other side. It's a quite phenomenal place, and I should really have enjoyed doing that, but it's never going to happen now. Tim, we've got about a minute, incredibly, and I suppose we ought to say thank you to all of our guests from all the clubs.
Thank you to everybody that's contributed. You know, it's been amazing. This program wouldn't happen without the guests that we get in, and we rely on good guests, and we've had some cracking guests this year.
And people with more general portfolios, like Matt Camp and like Darren Talbot, and of course we mustn't forget Howard Cohen, who came in back in February to help us out.
And we had our Wisden journalist as well coming in.
And Wisden Cricket Monthly. So it's not just been about local clubs, although I hope that maybe we'll attract one or two more local clubs next season. Perhaps get Outwood's great local rival South Nutfield back in, because they've not been with us for a couple of years, and I think that's
a shame. It'd be nice to get them back,
Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure as always, and we'll see what we can do by way of a winter special, but let's leave that for the day, think. Tim, thank you.
Thanks very much, David.
Always a pleasure. And that was the final On the Front Foot. We've done 8 this season. Hope you've enjoyed it half as much as we have. All of our shows are available at Listen Again On Demand on the Suzy website. As Tim and I just said, we're hoping to do something or other in the winter, not quite sure what yet. And we'll be back in February or March, as probably the international schedule demands. It's a huge pleasure, and we're glad that people are enjoying the show, and if it's all the way to the US of A, well, why not? My name's David Jay, and until the next On the Front Foot, time to wish you a very good evening.